how it's possible to look at them without looking at human-induced climate change.
Yes, I think what's clear from a climate science perspective at this point is that all weather events are evolving in the context of a changed climate. That is just the reality of the world we live in today. The question is really to what extent is climate change influencing certain kinds of events, not really whether it is in the first place. It's really a question of how much. And in this case, we know that the primary link between climate change and extreme precipitation events is through a fairly basic fundamental principle of atmospheric thermodynamics. That sounds complicated, but it really just comes down to the fact that the atmosphere has a much higher capacity to hold water vapor when it's warmer. In fact, the increase in the water vapor holding capacity of the atmosphere is exponential, even for a linear or an incremental warming. So this is a pretty profound effect because it raises effectively the ceiling on how intense precipitation can become by about 4% per degree Fahrenheit or 7% per degree centigrade of global warming. And so today we're at about 1.2 degrees or so centigrade of global warming. We're at the point where perhaps 10 to 15% of the intensity of any given extreme precipitation event on average can probably be attributed to global warming. And of course, that number is going to vary from event to event and region to region. But as a ballpark estimate, that 10 to 15% increase in the magnitude of extreme precipitation events can have really large effects already.
And could you explain one of the things that's seems surprising about what's happening in California is that, of course, this is a state that has suffered from massive drought over the last several years. So how do these things go together? On the one hand, drought, on the other hand, this extraordinary level of rain.
Well, there is, first of all, a bit of a silver lining here, which is that, of course, with all of this rain, the severity of the California drought is decreasing with each passing week. Of course, in the long run, they don't just simply counterbalance each other, the extreme dry and moving immediately to extreme wet. There are lots of reasons why it's not an equal and opposite response. But in this part of the world, there's actually an expectation that climate change will bring about an increase in what I like to term hydroclimate or precipitation whiplash, if you will. This notion that
This is
the variability from
KBOO.
season to season, precipitation in California.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Eastern Oregon counties get federal funds to address groundwater pollution. Pacific Northwest farmers come up with new strategies in the face of the climate crisis, and House Republicans open an investigation into the Biden family. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 12th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. Morrow and Umatilla counties in eastern Oregon will receive $1.7 million in federal aid to address contamination of their drinking water. Groundwater in the lower Umatilla Basin has been found to have high levels of nitrates. Some Morrow County residents have water with 4 to 5 times the legal limits of nitrates. High levels of nitrates have detrimental health effects like respiratory infections, thyroid dysfunction, and stomach and bladder cancer. Nitrates have been polluting the area since the 1990s when Oregon first identified the issue. Morrow County has been under an emergency order since June related to polluted water. That order ended on December 31st. Many residents rely on free water being delivered to them since their private wells are contaminated. The $1.7 million comes from the federal funding package passed last year. It'll go towards finding a long-term solution to the issue and more thoroughly testing the wells. Recent extreme heat events have impacted agriculture in the Pacific Northwest. Farmers in the region are considering how to prepare for a change in climate. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Northwest farmers have been dealing with extreme heat over the past few years. It's pushing some to wonder what the future of agriculture will be like in the region. Keith Veselka manages 1,400 acres of apple and cherry orchards for NWFM LLC in Yakima. He says they've implemented a number of techniques to deal with warmer summer temperatures, but these methods are costly.
Growers up here are trying to mitigate some of the impact of intense heat and UV with shade netting and misters that we use to help do evaporative cooling in the orchard.
Veselka has installed evaporative cooling at about 90% of his sites, covering about 30% of his crops. He says it leads to about 20 to 30% less damage. Veselka says mitigation costs come on top of increased costs in other areas, such as labor, and that's hard especially on small growers. Washington State leads the nation in apple and sweet cherry production. A deadly heat dome that descended on the Northwest in 2021 emphasized for many growers that they need to be prepared for the future. Chad Kruger is director of Washington State University's Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources. He's quick to point out that extreme weather like that can be instructive. However, it's not the same as knowing what we will experience in the future. Kruger says growers tend to plan based on historic experiences, but that won't be the best indicator as the climate changes. Instead, he says there are other ways for farmers to prepare.
Try and get your hands on the latest forecasts and information and ask questions. In the context of my production system or what I do, where might I be vulnerable to one of these forecasted changes coming forward?
Kruger says most climate models predict a 4 to 6 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperatures by mid-century. He says producers should consider what effect this will have on their long-term decision-making, such as the long cycle for planting and growing an orchard.
Climate change, like many issues, is a longer time horizon issue where decisions we make that have 10, 20, 30, 40-year long impacts are the ones we really need to be concerned about.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. This story was produced with original reporting from Michael Crow for Civil Eats.
Farmers in the Pacific Northwest aren't the only ones thinking about agriculture in a climate crisis future. As North Carolina temperatures rise and rainfall grows erratic, planting different crops is one way local farmers can adapt to climate change. A starchy root vegetable called taro, originating in Southeast Asia, holds promise. Nadia Ramlagan has the details on the farmer's strategy.
One North Carolina farm is experimenting with growing taro as part of an effort to make the local food system more resilient to climate change. The starchy root vegetable is a staple in Southeast Asia and is among the world's oldest cultivated plants. Utopian Seed Project founder Chris Smith says this summer he's partnering with regional farms to study Korean, Filipino, and Hawaiian varieties of taro. The farmers will track costs, yields, sales, and other data. Smith adds, taro is emerging a winner when it comes to resistance to warming temperatures and heavy rain.
So the question becomes, what are our crop options in a changing climate? And taro, in our trials so far, with lots and lots of different tropical crops, taro's just kind of risen to the top very quickly.
One NASA study found within the next 10 years, climate change could diminish the yields of wheat and corn by as much as 17 and 24%, making crops such as taro even bigger players. Smith explains taro is also tasty and can be steamed, fried, boiled, and braised, similar to the potato. He notes chefs in Asheville are eager for a local supply.
We work with a lot of restaurants. It's not just having something that will grow, it's also having something that people want to eat. And taro just has a lot of different culinary applications.
Smith points out the quest to grow taro in the South reflects a broader theme of diversifying crops to protect agriculture from the hazards of climate change.
If we can get to a stage where the food system has shifted to embrace this crop that isn't currently known in this region, then that's how we're going to define our own success.
While farming is an uncertain business, Smith says he expects taro to be readily available in North Carolina within the next few years. This story was produced with original reporting from Lena Tran for Grist. This is Nadia Ramlagan for North Carolina News Service.
Multiple former staff of Multnomah County Animal Services say there are systemic problems with animal abuse. New Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson promises to review the current practices. It's not the first time that poor animal care has been called out for a shelter. County audits in 2016 and 2018 reflected that too for basic standards of care. That includes things like cleaning kennels, feeding the animals, and allowing them adequate access to exercise and mental stimulation. Former employees say that it got worse when the shelter shut down for in-person visits during the pandemic. The shelter just reopened to the public on Wednesday. The former employees also described a culture of retaliation at the workplace related to the animals' care. Amy Previn was an animal care tech for 4.5 years at Multnomah County Animal Services. Previn told KGW, quote, "I just did not feel comfortable with what I saw as the inhumane treatment of animals. The more I questioned it, the more I seemed to be out of favor with management," end quote. More classified documents connected to President Biden have been found, and the House creates a subcommittee to investigate federal abuses of authority. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
He takes classified documents and information seriously. He was surprised to learn any records had been found there. He doesn't know what was in them.
A second set of classified documents belonging to President Joe Biden, dating back to the Obama administration, has been found. It follows a similar discovery last fall at his former think tank. The contents and classification level of the documents have not been determined. House Republicans are calling for a special counsel to investigate the president, just as former President Donald Trump is being investigated for the removal of classified documents from the White House. Meanwhile, the House voted to approve the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. The bill, which passed 220 to 210, would require healthcare professionals to preserve the life of an infant in the rare case a baby is born alive during or after an attempted abortion. Though the bill is almost certain to fail in the Senate, experts say the bill is laying out the priorities of the Republican-controlled House. Representative Amelia Sykes, the Ohio Democrat, spoke about her party's reproductive health care goals.
Our focus in this Congress should be to guarantee the American people have access to accurate health information, including their reproductive health. As we talk about crisis pregnancy centers today, we need to be clear and transparent about what these centers are actually able to do and, most importantly, not do.
Healthcare providers failing to comply could face fines or up to 5 years in prison. However, the bill would not impose penalties on the mother and would grant her protection from any prosecution. The House also passed a bill condemning recent attacks on pro-life facilities, groups, and churches. The House is creating a select subcommittee to study what some Republicans are calling the weaponization of the federal government. It would investigate federal abuses of authority in the style of those done by the Church Committee in the 1970s. Representative Tim Cole explained why he believes the subcommittee is necessary.
The select subcommittee will operate as a select investigative subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee and will be tasked with studying and reporting on the executive branch's authority to collect information on or otherwise investigate citizens of the United States.
Calls for Representative George Santos of New York to resign are hitting close to home. The Nassau County Republican Committee is calling for him to resign, saying lies told during his campaign make him unfit to serve. Joseph Cairo, Nassau County Republican chairman, described why he believes Santos needs to go.
George Santos' campaign last year was a campaign of deceit, lies, fabrication. He deceived the voters of the 3rd Congressional District. Deceived members of the Nassau County Republican Committee.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Now that Republicans narrowly control the House of Representatives, they've opened an investigation into President Biden and his son, Hunter. KBOO's Josh Salem has the details.
House Republicans just opened a long-promised investigation into President Joe Biden and his family. They requested information from the Treasury Department and some former Twitter executives, possibly laying the groundwork for public hearings. James Comer, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, said, quote, "Now that Democrats no longer have one-party rule in Washington, oversight and accountability are coming," end quote. The Republicans have a small majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, and the committee is led by Republicans as well. It sent a series of letters requesting information about financial transactions by members of the Biden family that were flagged as suspicious activities. Large financial transactions are automatically flagged and are not evidence of misconduct on their own. The legislators also requested testimony from multiple former Twitter executives who were involved in the company's handling of an October 2020 story about Hunter Biden, the president's younger son. Republicans say that story was suppressed for political reasons. Ian Sams, a White House spokesman, said, quote, In their first week as a governing majority, House Republicans have not taken any meaningful action to address inflation and lower Americans' costs. Yet they're jumping out of the gate with political stunts driven by the most extreme MAGA members of their caucus in an effort to get attention on Fox News, end quote. The Republicans detailed a plan for investigating the Biden family the day after clinching a slim majority in the November midterm elections. They apparently want to probe the business dealings of Hunter Biden and one of the president's brothers, James. Republican lawmakers and their staff have been discussing for the last year messages and financial transactions found on a laptop that belonged to Hunter Biden. But now they have subpoena power in the House, giving them the authority to compel testimony and to conduct a more aggressive investigation. Hunter Biden's taxes and foreign business work are already under federal investigation, with a grand jury in Delaware hearing testimony in recent months. He never held a position on the presidential campaign or in the White House, but his membership on the board of a Ukrainian energy company in some efforts to strike deals in China have raised questions about whether he capitalized on his father's positions. President Biden said he has never spoken to his son about his foreign business. The Treasury Department declined to comment. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon's voter-passed gun control measure is still on hold while the courts assess its constitutionality. Elsewhere, though, the Illinois General Assembly passed the Protect Illinois Communities Act on Tuesday, a bill that bans military-style assault rifles and puts limits on other weapons. Illinois becomes the ninth state to approve this type of gun control measure. Second Amendment advocates are vowing to sue. Mark Richardson has more.
Illinois has become the ninth state to approve a statewide ban on assault rifles and high-capacity ammunition magazines. On Tuesday, the Protect Illinois Communities Act, passed by the General Assembly along party lines, bans AR-15s and other military-style weapons and limits long gun magazines to 10 rounds and handguns to 15. The measure was passed just 6 months following a mass shooting at a July 4th parade in Highland Park that left 7 people dead and 48 injured. Sherry Wilson with the Illinois chapter of Moms Demand Action says it's been a long haul, but was worth it.
Regular citizens should not be having access to weapons of war. These massacres that we see on the news are typically a result of having an assault weapon by the hand of the shooter. So that is significant.
Governor J.B. Pritzker says he will sign the legislation. Gun rights advocates and firearm dealers have vowed to take the state to court over the ban, calling it a clear violation of Second Amendment rights. Current owners would be able to keep their guns for limited use, but must register them and provide serial numbers to the Illinois State Police. The bill also includes expedited implementation of universal background checks, but does not change the age for firearms ID cards. Wilson says the measure contains many of the elements her group wanted in a gun control measure.
It addresses gun suicide, assault weapons, and getting the serial numbers onto these weapons is really important, and that's one of the things that we pushed for.
Wilson says Moms Demand Action was created shortly after the Sandy Hook shooting took place in December 2012, and many of its members have connections to people killed or injured in mass shootings.
The reason why we do this work is so that we recognize the people that have had their lives taken from gun violence and also the surviving family members and friends, because that pain just never goes away.
For Illinois News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. Then at 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 53. Today in history, in 1915, the United States House rejects a proposal requiring states to give women the right to vote. The quote of the day is from American jazz musician and composer Alice Coltrane, who died this day in 2007. Coltrane said, quote, "Women have been held back and limited throughout the centuries. Creation could not have been rendered, not even considered, let alone brought into manifestation without woman. She is principle, a powerful energy. She is first." Religious groups have written friends of the court briefs to support an Apache legal fight against a copper mine. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Several religious groups are urging a federal appeals court to protect an Apache sacred site in Arizona from one of the nation's largest copper mines. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the court will rehear the case in March.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Seventh-day Adventists, along with the Sikh and Jewish coalitions, among others, recently filed what are called Friend of the Court briefs. They're asking the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to stop a federal land swap that would transfer ownership of portions of Oak Flat east of Phoenix to the international mining company Rio Tinto. The groups say if the mine goes forward, it would harm the spiritual practices of the Apache people and threaten the religious freedom and civil rights of all faiths. Oak Flat is located on the Tonto National Forest and is home to key religious ceremonies practiced by the Western Apache. The group Apache Stronghold is suing the federal government to prevent the land swap. They and other indigenous organizations argue the mine would destroy the sacred site and end Apache spiritual practices there. The company says it's committed to tribal consultation and protecting cultural heritage, and that such input has informed significant changes in the project's design. The Ninth Circuit Court will rehear the case in March before a full 11-judge panel. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Alaska Native people are mourning the loss of a North Slope leader who grew up running sled dog teams to collect firewood along the Arctic coast and came of an age in the time of snow machines, borough governments, and Native corporations. Oliver Levitt died Sunday at the age of 79. Levitt was also a whaling captain and a cultural beacon for his people, fluent in Inupiaq and known for his ability to build boats without a blueprint.
Without a piece of paper in your hand to go from dimensional wood, hardwood, and end up with a whaling boat is a skill.
Glenn says he admired Levitt for his ability to fight for his region and move comfortably from the boardroom to the whaling camp to the halls of Washington, D.C.
He was adept at it. He made it effortless. He has a diplomat skill, but he also has a hard-won, nuts-and-bolts kind of education.
An education Levitt used to help turn ASRC into Alaska's largest private company.
Well, we've known each other for, I think, over 50 years.
Willie Hensley, a leader in Alaska's Native land claims fight, first met Levitt when they got out of the Army. It was then, he says, that Levitt dedicated himself to a life of public service, working to form a new borough, teaming up with other leaders to turn ASRC into a company that earns billions in revenue each year.
He was persistent, and in order to do the things that he had to do, he had to work hard. He practically camped in Washington, D.C.
Hensley says one of Levitt's biggest accomplishments was his battle to help the North Slope Borough take over a U.S. Navy gas field, which enabled the borough to bring heat and power to the region. A memorial for Levitt is planned for Monday in Utqiagvik at the Barrow High School. A new housing development is in the works for the Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota. The Turtle Mountain Housing Authority recently closed with an investor to begin construction of a $19 million affordable housing project. It will provide 52 apartments for community members. The new development includes buildings with a mix of studio and 1- and 2-bedroom units. State and federal funds are helping with the project. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The United States Department of Justice announced it has launched a new version of the Americans with Disabilities Act website. As Nadia Ramlagan reports, advocates in Ohio say the new software on the site is one example of the increasing popularity of assistive technology.
The Americans with Disabilities Act website has gotten a makeover with updated navigation tools and easy-to-find answers to common questions on everything from service animals to accessible polling places. The federal government says it wants to better empower people to understand their and others' rights and equip workplaces, local governments, and other institutions to comply with the Disabilities Act. The new website also employs speech software to make it even more accessible. Connor McGarvey says the growing use of assistive technology is improving the lives of people living with disabilities and explains devices are becoming increasingly sophisticated, including using facial recognition tools.
The promise of technology is definitely something that has really opened up the lives of individuals with disabilities. So if they were to look at their caregiver or their parent, it will tell them who they're looking at. That's huge.
The latest census data show an estimated 10% of Ohioans under the age of 65 live with some type of disability. The number of people worldwide needing assistive technology is likely to reach more than 3 billion by 2050, largely driven by aging populations. Visit the new site at ada.gov or call the Justice Department's toll-free ADA information line at 1-800-514-0301. McGarvey adds numerous disability services operated by county boards in Ohio, funded by Medicaid, are possible through ADA legislation.
If you are receiving job coaching and community outreach and assistance finding a vocation in the community, all of that is funded through Medicaid.
The CDC says Ohio spends $35 billion each year, more than a third of the state healthcare budget, on services for people living with disabilities. This is Nadia Romlagan for Ohio News Connection.
A recent report says the newspaper industry is in decline, and they predict nearly one-third of journalism jobs will be lost by 2031. One expert says colleges and curriculum need to evolve as a result. Danielle Smith has more.
A report from the Georgetown University Center on Education and Workforce found the number of journalism jobs will continue to decline over the next decade. It says more than one-third of journalism jobs will be lost by 2031. The survey found job losses for journalists are the results of decades of decline, primarily due to newspapers downsizing and closures. Bernie Ankney with Point Park University says the newspaper industry has been struggling for over 30 years because advertising that once supported a daily newspaper has gone away. He adds it's time for educational institutions to shift as the industry is changing.
Newspapers aren't giving raises. The size of staff is shrinking some. It doesn't mean there's not tremendous value in a journalism education. It's just the industry has changed. And colleges and universities have had to change to address that.
The survey found employment by newspaper publishers has fallen 63%, but employment has increased up to six times what it once was in internet publishing, broadcasting, and online search portals. Ankney says the university has pivoted and now offers a curriculum that prepares students to work in five different areas of the journalism profession: radio, television, newspapers, multimedia, and photojournalism.
But it also prepares you for related fields. You might decide, I want to go into PR, ad, social media. If you do, our digital journalism track prepares you for that. You may decide you want to work for a website. We prepare you for that.
The survey also says journalists are not highly paid depending on the market, but Ankney adds there are still good opportunities at newspapers and magazines if students learn how to do multimedia reporting, such as writing and editing audio and video. I'm Danielle Smith, Keystone State News Connection.
The effort to curb climate change has now come to the pet food industry, where a few companies are starting to use protein from crickets and grubs, which produce far less carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrogen compared to cattle or chickens. Susan Potter reports.
Cats and dogs eat a lot of meat, and producing their food generates about 64 million tons of carbon dioxide a year, plus the land, water, and other resources required to raise farm animals. Now companies are developing a more sustainable wet dog food, kibble, and treats made from insects like crickets and fly larvae or grubs. Ann Carlson is founder and CEO of Jiminy's, currently the only company in the U.S. selling bug-based dog food.
It's less land, less water, almost no greenhouse gases. In fact, if you had an acre of land and you put chickens on it, at the end of a year, you're going to have 265 pounds of protein. But if you put crickets on that same land, you'll have 65,000 pounds of protein.
She says crickets' life cycle is short, which is why so many generations can be raised in a year. The bugs live indoors in egg carton-like vertical habitats. The entire insect is ground up for the food, and their bedding and waste are turned into fertilizer. Carlson says the resulting food has a nutty flavor similar to sunflower seeds, and research has proven it to be a safe, healthy source of protein.
It's a complete protein with all of the essential amino acids, but it also has vitamins, minerals, fiber. It's a superfood. And the fiber actually feeds the good bacteria in the dog's gut. It's prebiotic.
Carlson says some dogs with allergies have found relief with insect-based food, which is sold online and in pet stores across the country. This story was produced with original reporting from Claire Elise Thompson, associate editor for TheGrist.org, part of the Solutions Journalism Network. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 12th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Danielle Smith, Edwin J. Vieira, Suzanne Potter, Mark Richardson, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.